In our increasingly post-Christian world, and I think that's what we have, it's not all the way there, but it's getting there. It's certainly that way in Europe to a great degree, and it's that way somewhat here. People not only doubt the Bible, but depending on who you read and who you listen to, people will even describe the Bible as being immoral. That the Bible teaches or condones behavior that modern human civilization sees as immoral. Sam Harris, one of the four horsemen of four horsemen of the atheists or whatever they're going to like with Hitchens and Dawkins and so forth. He talks of slavery in the Bible in a letter to a Christian nation. He calls it an abomination, and he quotes Leviticus 25 verses 44 to 46, and I'll go ahead and read it now. I had it in here later, but I'm going to read it now. Leviticus 25. And verses 44 to 46, since this is what Sam Harris quoted. Both your bondmen and your bondmaids, which you shall have, they shall not be of the heathen. Shall they be of the heathen around about you? Of them you may buy bondsmen and bondsmaids. Moreover, of the children of strangers that do sojourn among you, of them you shall buy, and of their families that are with you, which they begat in your land. They shall be your possession, and you shall take them for an inheritance for your children after you, to inherit them for a possession. They shall be your bondmen forever. But over your brethren, the children of Israel, you shall not rule one another with rigor. Now, Sam Harris says that's an abomination. As some people would point out, that's a word he got from the Bible. But Christopher Hitchens, who died 2011, has a book, God Is Not Great. I have that book. I've had it since before he died. I still haven't read it. But in that book, he says, the Bible may, indeed does, contain a warrant for trafficking in humans, ethnic cleansing, slavery, bride price, and for indiscriminate massacre. We're not bound by any of it because it was put together by crude, uncultured human mammals. Pretty stinging criticism of the book that we value and those of us who value it. Perhaps you have looked at some of the scriptures that Hitchens and Harris and the others talk about, and perhaps you've been a bit concerned yourself. I know I have been concerned. If we look at it somewhat rationally, if we can do that, we could have some reasoning that goes something like this. Bible translations that we have in English, they talk about slaves. The Old Testament seems to have no problem. We just read a couple of verses. Seems to have no problem with having slaves, no objection. The New Testament doesn't command the Christians to get rid of their slaves. It tells you if you are a slave to be submissive. Therefore, it seems that the Bible texts approve of slavery. But we in the 21st century know, and even in the 20th century, we, the civilized people of this world, know that slavery is wrong. So therefore, if you follow this reasoning here, the Bible texts approve of something that is wrong. That's the way they look at it. How would you answer that kind of criticism? How do you handle an argument like that? I would suggest that it's not easy, but what I would like to do in this sermon and the next, it's going to take two sermons, is look at the subject of slavery as it's presented in the Bible. And this week we'll spend our time on what I would call the big picture. And we'll get some background, some context here. What are the words in the Bible that are translated as slave in our English translations? How should we understand those words? How should we understand slavery in the Bronze Age or even in the Iron Age? Slavery in Israel. How about the Greco-Roman context, the later New Testament slavery? What exactly do we mean by slavery when we use the term today? What are we thinking of? What are we You know, what were Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens thinking about, or what was Christopher Hitchens thinking about when he was alive? How ought we to look at the law? The Torah, the instructions. How should we view those? Especially, you know, here we are in the modern world. How should we look at them? Especially the first five books I'm talking about. So with this background and context in mind, then the next time I'm here in a few weeks, we'll look at the biblical texts. We're going to glance at them today, but we'll look at the biblical texts in detail and learn to better understand how they fit in their own world and how this should be applied now. So that's what we're going to do. But today, we're going to look at the big picture somewhat. I've done a lot of research on this subject because, for my own good, I wanted to understand. Someone, actually a teenager, asked me the question, wanted me to explain. And I realized I didn't know enough to explain. And I needed some time to do the research, to do the work. And I have to say that I have not always been pleased with the resources that are available to me, and I have quite a few resources. And I have not been pleased with them, some of them. They're not always thorough. They're not always complete. Many treatments of the subject, in my opinion, are very incomplete. They often leave important verses inadequately addressed or not addressed at all. Specifically, the one I just read, Leviticus 25, verses 44, 45, 46. You can get all kinds of explanations about how to understand slavery in the Bible. Very few of them will go to that verse, because it's tough. It's a tough one. We're not going to answer that all today, but you know, it's not easy. And so the people that want to give a fair, you know, a short, simplistic, maybe they don't want to give a simplistic explanation, but in order to have a short one, maybe that's digestible in 5 minutes on the internet, you can't cover all of what I'm going to cover today. But I think it's important to cover it. It was important for me, and I want to share with you what I've learned. By the way, Leviticus 25 that I just read, that's after a whole lot of instructions on how it is that the Israelites were to handle slavery among themselves. The word slavery in the Bible, but I'll get to that too. The word slavery in our translations sometimes. Excuse me. So for all the resources I've had and all the things that I've read and all the things I've listened to, I'd have to say that I'm heavily indebted to one individual, really one resource. It's the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas, and they sponsor these seminars every once in a while and bring people in to talk. And those seminars and discussions go into things a lot deeper than perhaps normally. And back in 2015, in October, they had a session where they invited people in to talk about slavery in the Bible as it's presented in the Bible. And in particular, Peter J. Williams, who is, he's got a job at Tyndale Publishers, or the Tyndale House in London. It's different than the Tyndale that's in America. But he's also been a college professor and so forth. He's a biblical scholar, and he's on the ESV Translation Committee. So he also is learned in Greek and Hebrew. And he's a Brit, so he has a slightly different perspective than we do, which is also helpful. Where are we going to start? I got a question. I don't have a board, that's okay. I was going to write some things, but what is meant by the English word? And we, you know, our Bibles weren't written in English, but that's what we have in front of us. What is meant by the word slavery or the word slave? And I want some input here. What do you think of when you hear that word slave? How would you describe someone who is a slave? Or how would you describe slavery? What determines whether someone is a slave or not? What determines whether a situation is slavery? Maybe it's not just one thing, but let's build a database here. Property? Meaning they are property. They are owned. Someone owns somebody else. Good, that's one. Yes. I'm sorry? Bondage would be another word for slavery. What do you mean specifically? You mean that they actually have a shackle on them or something like that? Or good? Okay. Yes?
I'll say more like servitude. slaves who we make, the slaves that we have in this country, that they would be abused and so forth like that.
Servitude that doesn't necessarily include abuse. Okay, that's one of the reasons there has been slave there have been there is slavery historically. Yes. Anything else? Yes.
Lack of self determination. They can't do anything on their own. They have to rely on their master to tell them what to do.
Total reliance on the master. They have no rights. By the way, last time I was here, I spoke on do we have rights as Christians, and I told you it might kind of lead into the subject that I wasn't ready to speak on last time. But yeah, a slave has no rights, at least not many. Actually, the truth is, I should qualify that, because in the Torah, slaves have certain rights. In Hammurabi's code, there are certain rules about slaves, same as in Roman law. There were certain rules, but in Roman law, you didn't have any rights, so the slaves had none. But in other cultures, depending on the circumstances, sometimes there were rights, but not much. But I'm asking you what you think of. You know, what do we think of as modern Americans when we think of slavery? And we've got ownership, we've got lack of rights, we've got a possible mistreatment, bondage. Anything else? I think there's an obvious one nobody said yet.
Like people being kept oppressed and uneducated.
Oh, okay, that's a good one. Can I write that down? There's an effort there could be an effort to keep someone in that circumstance by lack of education and opportunity for advancement and so on. Yes. Excuse me while I write that down for next time. Yes.
I was going to say, I think the first thing that comes into our minds is the African slaves brought over to into the New World, whether it was in the Caribbean or all the way up through. I mean, that's the slavery that we identify with.
So as Westerners, yeah, we think of the North American slavery that our country was part of, and it predated our country. The French and the English traded people across the ocean. Anything else? There's one great big obvious thing.
They're used to work.
They have to work, typically. I mean, that's where you're a slave, so that you're producing something. So work, I was just thinking maybe we all just assume that, but that's got to be part of it. And actually, it's important to remember that as we go through this. Yes?
The concept of slavery didn't just end with the slave himself, but extended to his children.
Right. It could be inherited or passed on or whatever, right word. Yeah.
Never said they don't get money when they work. They don't get paid for their work.
No pay. Okay. Yeah. It's good. I'm adding to my notes. No, they had to get something. You have to keep them alive or they can't work. All right. Is slavery, as we just defined it, necessarily wrong? What do you think? You don't have to show a hand. Maybe you don't, if you don't mind. I mean, do most of us think that forced labor, owning of human beings, being shackled, perhaps, having no rights, being mistreated, not getting paid, being forced, being denied access to education and betterment. Do most of us feel that that's not appropriate, that we don't like that? So we can understand, perhaps, how a Christopher Hitchens or a Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins or the other guy whose name I can't remember right now can say, look, you believe in a book here, and you claim it's your guide to life, and it approves of this stuff. Well, if it does, they have a point. Now, obviously, I don't believe that it does approve of the things that we just described. But it's going to take a while. I think it's going to take more than a five-minute thing on YouTube to explain that and make it obvious. Yes?
I think at that point in time, cruelty of man coming into this country agreed that caused that kind of slavery. Before that, you had indentured servants, which they could buy themselves out of slavery and become free.
That's one. We'll talk about that. There are different types of bondage, if you want to put it that way. It wasn't always indentured servants, though. In Rome, they had slavery that was just as bad as what we had in North America.
Joseph, he was a slave, but he was his master's foreman and took care of his house.
And
which
good.
Wasn't a bad thing. He became up until he was accused of.
Good point.
Bad things.
Yeah, we'll talk about all this background because it all matters to understanding the topic. Yes.
Well, you're not ready to go there yet, but if you're a Christian, you're a slave.
Oh yeah, and I've talked about that. You may not have been there. In years past, I had a series on slavery, the typology in the New Testament, especially that Paul uses. Absolutely, yes. And we'll talk a little bit about that, but that's not the overall purpose here. Is forced labor always wrong? What do you think? I mean, your knee-jerk reaction is, well, yeah, but is it always wrong? Okay, it's a good one. Any other ideas for the is it necessarily wrong? Is it always wrong, or is there a possible good reason or good purpose to forced labor? Anybody think of another example of forced labor? Maybe not for any. Maybe well, some of us. Yes.
Taking my teenagers to work.
Oh, sorry.
Taking my teenagers to work.
Just having teenagers is forced labor, but that's another issue. Yes.
I don't know whether you would call it force, but if you want to work and you want to have an income and you work for a company, that is forced on you to work that 8 hours or 16 hours or whatever to accomplish what they need to be accomplished. So that's a type of forced labor.
In a way. I mean, I'll mention that later on, but yeah, I mean, you have the right to walk away from that job and starve, but, you know. So we think, I was going to mention this later, but I'll just mention, we think we're free. We're the land of the free and the home of the brave. Well, yeah, try to disconnect one time. It's not, and I don't mean just from the internet. I mean just disconnect from society. I was going to turn there later, but you know the scriptures. Revelation, what is it, 13? You know, if you don't have the mark of the beast, whatever in the world that is, but the symbolism's clear. If you're not part of the system, you can't buy, you can't sell, you won't eat. You know, there's a system. The world has a system. And yeah, we don't have a shackle on us that actually ties us to a job, but in a way we do. In a way we do. So, okay. Anybody think of another example of forced labor?
Military
draft. Is that necessarily wrong? Now, we don't want to, we might be conscientious objectors, but in general, society says that's an acceptable form of forced labor. You know, you don't get a choice. You draft, you go in the military. And they tell you what to do, when to get up, when to go to bed, and how to dress, how to make your bed, blah, blah, blah. That's forced labor. We think we have it bad with our parents, you know. You know, go to the Army. That's why people always, you know, the old joke about, I'm getting out of here, I can't stand all the rules of this house, I'm going to go join the Army. Yes. Somebody else had it. Yes. If women and children what? Oh, in abusive situations, okay. All right. I got another example. As an employer, I've had people that work for me that have to pay for children that they don't live with. It's called child support. So they have to work and pay that. And it's a debt that they have. They don't have any choice. And I have to take it out of their pay and send it in. And, you know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's forced labor. They don't really have much choice. If they don't pay it, they go to jail. So we have, even in our modern enlightened society, we have some examples of what you might term forced labor. Even uncompensated. I mean, now that we pay our people in the military, I don't think we pay our prisoners when they go out and clean the road. But I mean, we have examples of it. So what then is immoral about slavery? What's immoral about slavery? When Sam Harris calls it an abomination, you know, because it's immoral, what is it that's immoral? We'd say, well, owning people. We're kind of like against that. What else? Bondage, the shackling somebody? Is there other things that...
Well, I think in many cases, if they're treated as property, then they're almost taken to the level of animals because they're breeding for profit
mm-hmm.
to That's immoral.
North American slavery was definitely like that.
Yep.
Yeah. So those things seem to be immoral. And, again, we'll get into this. It's a big topic, but... Well, I'll save it for later. I mean, again, the whole point of this is to get a big picture so that we can think what we're talking about when we talk about slavery. And to be careful that we're not projecting 19th century North American slavery onto the Bible when it shouldn't be. Maybe sometimes it should be, maybe sometimes it shouldn't be, but we need to be able to know the difference. I've said this before, and you're probably tired of hearing it, but context is king. In the years that I have spent studying the world of the Bible, and I've shared a lot of that with you over the years, I've learned a tremendous amount, and it was no different than studying slavery. To understand Leviticus 25 or Exodus 21 or any of the other verses about slavery, you have to understand their world, the world it was written in. And we've talked a lot about that over the last 10 years at least, maybe 15, however long I've been more interested in that. Learning about their world so that we understand what is being discussed. Okay, let's first talk. I'm going to talk, I think I got four, maybe five areas I want to cover today, I hope. The first one, it's very interesting to me, and this I got from Peter Williams in that talk. Some of it I got. There's one word in Hebrew, basically, that's the only one we need to know. And if I were writing it up on the board, I'd write E-B-E-D, Ebed or E-V-E-D, Eved. I don't know Hebrew. But that's the word that's used and sometimes translated slave. But you know what's really interesting? If you have a King James Bible, which I have in front of me, I did a search on my Logos software, just did it this morning, because somebody had told me that the word slave only appears in the King James Bible twice. Now, that doesn't seem possible, does it? It's like, why is that? Well, it's interesting to begin here because it'll tell us something that I think we need to know. It is true. The word slave, the English word slave, is only in the King James Bible twice. If you want to know where they are, Jeremiah 2:14. This is especially interesting. Jeremiah 2:14, where it says, "Is Israel a servant? Is he a homeborn slave? Why is he spoiled?" Okay, is he a servant? Is he a homeborn slave? That's, I've talked about this before here. That's parallelism. It's a form of Hebrew poetry. Say the same thing twice in a slightly different way. Does anybody actually have the King James in front of them reading it? What do you notice about the word slave there? It's in italics. So that's the first usage of the word slave in English translations is not even there. It's italics. So what you have is in the Hebrew, you have the word for servant, you have ebed there for servant, but it's a poetic thing where you have to have the is he this, is he this? So in order to do that and understand in English, the translators had to add another word, and they added slave, homeborn slave. The word homeborn is in there, but slave isn't. So the first use of slave in the King James doesn't even exist in Hebrew, for what that's worth. But that's the only one in the Old Testament. The second one is in Revelation 18, verse 13, and you don't need to turn there, but it's talking about the body. It's translated slaves, but it's bodies and souls of men. Once again, it's not really talking about slaves. Not talking about slaves. It's saying they trade in the bodies and souls of men. And those words are words for bodies and souls. It's not doulos, which is the word that's normally, or doulos, which is normally translated slave in the New Testament and other translations. Now, some of you have the New King James. Guess what? There's 46 occurrences of the word slave in the New King James. If you look at other translations, I have New American Standard that I study in most of the time. If you compare, like the Revised Standard Version to the New Revised Standard Version, or you compare the Jewish Publication Society translation from 1917 of the Old Testament to the one that was redone and revamped in 1985, I think it was 85. Anytime you look at the old versions versus the newer versions, a lot more translations of the word eved in Hebrew to slave in the newer ones, but not in the older ones. So why is that? You know, translators are trying to make things accessible in the language and culture that they're translating in. And in the West, where we speak English, our attitudes towards slavery have changed quite a bit in the last 100 years. And we all tend to think it's an abomination now. Didn't necessarily used to think that. And so words and certain phrases that have that word eved in it, that didn't used to get translated slave, now times more times are translated slavery or slave. It's true, by the way, according to the lecture that I listened to, in other languages. This guy, Pete Williams, can read the Bible in about, I forget, 12 different languages. And the Luther Bible, same thing. There's the original Luther Bible, very, very few. I think it was zero. Zero uses of whatever the German word is for slave. But in the revised one, I don't know when that was, sometime in the 20th century, there's a bunch of them. So things change. We have different approaches, and we choose different words to translate a word that in the Hebrew never did change. The word eved, or ebed, however you say it, is translated servant a lot of times. It's translated slave a few times. And like I say, in the King James, it's not. If I turn to Leviticus 25 and verse 42, where we were before, it says, "For they are my servants whom I brought from the land of Egypt. They are not to be sold in a slave trade." That's the New American Standard Version. "They're my servants. They're not to be sold in a slave trade." That word is eved in both cases. So the translators, to try to make sense of it, decided to translate it one time as servant and one time as slave, because slave trade means something to us. Is that what was intended originally? Well, that's what translators argue about when they get in their closed-door meetings, and they can't talk once they get out of those meetings why they decided what they decided. But they don't all agree all the time. That's what happens in a when you decide what word in English do we want to choose here. Servant and slave used to overlap more than it does now. When we think servant, we think somebody who's helping and so forth, but, you know, things have changed. I'm not old enough. I don't know that anybody here is old enough to remember household servants, but that's what they used to be called. Now, we would never call, you know, now that my wife is not just limping around a little bit and getting older. Somebody comes in once in a while, and we say she cleans our house. She really doesn't, because Shelby's already got it clean before she shows up. But anyway, she comes. But there's no way we would call that person a servant. You know, you don't call your babysitter a servant. You call her an au pair or a nanny, right? You don't call, if you have a cook, you don't call that cook a servant. You know, I have a servant. I got some servants back at the place. We don't say that anymore, do we? But 100 years ago, 150 years ago, we did. So there's a change in the way we use our language. Household servants, you know, we wouldn't be caught dead now using that term. Because now servant has somewhat negative connotation. But there was a time when it didn't, at least not in the same way. The meaning of the word eved. This is interesting. Anybody know or want to guess? Yeah, it's all translated servant, slave. What does that word have to do with? What do you think? Work. It has to do with work. It's just the word. It kind of means work. It's in the Bible as a noun or a verb in the Old Testament Hebrew over 1,800 times. It has to do with work. Because this whole topic has to do with work. And yes, sometimes we call it slavery, sometimes serve. You know, we use all these different terms, but the bottom line of it is it's work. It has to do with work. And we all have to work, as Ray says. You know, we kind of, like, we can't unplug totally or we go hungry. So somehow we got to work. Maybe we can somehow get off the grid and go out and farm and raise enough food that we can eat and not have to be in contact with the rest of the world. It's very hard to do, but I guess it can be done. But for most of us, we're connected somehow, and we have to work. And even if you're disconnected, you know, from the grid, you still have to work. We all have to work. It's just it's common to our being human, right? And what did, this isn't in my notes, but, you know, God told Adam and Eve, what did he tell them to do? Besides be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, but they were supposed to do what to the earth? Dress it, keep it, and, you know, they're supposed to work. They're supposed to do, you know, they represented God on the earth to do the things that God wanted done on the earth. So, this always has to do with the idea of Ebed, the word that's translated slavery sometimes, has to do with work, and it has to do with working for someone. Not just working independently like you just want to work so you can eat, but it has to do with a relationship between you and the person you work for. That's the way it always appears in Hebrew. And I guess you could say that, you know, the general meaning is servant. A servant. And it has to do with a relationship. Somebody is subservient to someone else. If you're an Israelite or an Egyptian or whoever you are back in the Bronze Age, you are servants of who? And I'm not talking about God in this case, or the people. The people are servants of the king. The king is the servant of the gods or God. And that's the way it was. And as Bob Dylan said, those of you that know Bob Dylan songs, you got to serve somebody. Everybody's got to serve somebody. And that's the way it always was. That's the way he says it still is. And in the time of the Old Testament, the concept that we have, and this is where it ties into my last sermon, of freedom, the home of the land of the free and the home of the brave, that means nothing in the Old Testament. Nobody's free. You say, aha, but the Israelites were free from Egypt, right? Well, maybe. Look, I'll talk about that in a minute. You can think about that. You can figure out the answer. Everyone is subservient to someone else. Everybody is Eved, you know, is in a work-boss relationship with someone. That's just a truism in the Bible. So for us to project our 21st century sensitivities to that back on the Bronze Age or the Iron Age in Israel it's a case of what they call that. It's an anachronism. They didn't think that way then. Everybody had to work. You knew you had to work. Everybody worked for somebody. That's just the way it was. And it wasn't the same as, you know, we didn't have the same kind of economy that we have now. To be a servant of someone wasn't a put down. It doesn't have a negative connotation. Obadiah. Think of that word. Obadiah, the guy's name. It's Obadiah. Work or servant of Yah, God. That's an honorable thing. Obadiah, the servant of Yahweh. That's not, oh, you poor guy, you're the servant. No, that was a title of respect and honor, that Obadiah is a servant of Yahweh. So that's getting back into the mentality of the people that wrote the Old Testament. So it's always about this relationship. It's a positive. It can be a positive thing or a negative thing. But the question is, what is that relationship like? If you're working for someone, how is that someone treating you? That would be perhaps a question. How does the boss treat the workers? So when we translate that, when the Bible translators translate the word Eved into slave, you could be inviting a problem. Because, why? Because back then, most of the people that were in that kind of situation, and some of you pointed that out, were not in anything at all like the situation endured by North American slaves back in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries. Or I guess it's the 18th and 19th centuries. It was nothing like that. But in our minds, when we think slavery, especially as Americans, which I assume we all are, we think of the slavery that happened on our territory. But that's not the same kind of slavery that happened back then. It's not to say people weren't abused, and especially in the Roman Empire, but I would get to that later. So you can get an inconsistency. You can just like I showed you, you can have the word eved in twice in the same verse and translate it two different ways because it seems to, maybe it makes more sense to you, but maybe that's not exactly how it was intended in the first place. In the Old Testament, in general, when you think that word eved, we should think servant. Servant. And New Testament's different words and maybe different way of looking at it. Get there later. It's hard to read about what some translations call slavery in the Bible without projecting onto it either a Greek or Roman idea of slavery or a North American idea of slavery or something else. And there's plenty of other slaves. I met a friend down in Colombia, and I was mentioning this to, and he's a black man, and so I don't know how it came up, but we're talking about the effects of slavery. And I said, you know, I just read a book, and I read this book by Peter Frankopan on the Silk Roads. And so any of you have done the 23andMe gene thing? You know, I have. And I've talked to almost everybody that does that gets Scandinavian blood in them. I think, why is that? Because the Vikings were so prolific? No, I don't think so. When I was reading Peter Frankopan's book, he pointed out how that during parts of the Middle Ages, when the Arabic empires, the Arab and the Central Asian empires were so powerful, they weren't all Arab, some of them were Arab, some of them weren't, but Central Asian powers were so powerful, they went up to Norway. Well, it wasn't Norway then, but they went up to Scandinavia and kidnapped people, brought them down, made them slaves. And, you know, so they're passing all through Europe and down into Central Asia. And so they're all over the place. And, you know, where do we come from in America? All over the place. And, you know, there's along the way, all these Scandinavian blood got mixed in. That's off the subject just a little bit. But the point is that there's slaves from every race of people throughout history. And you know, trafficking in humans. This has been part of our human experience. Okay, let's see what I... So we need to be careful, need to be careful not to read our somewhat modern experience with slavery in America back onto the Bible. Because whether it's better or worse, or, you know, in either case, it's different. It's different in the Bible. So that's the first point. This word, we're just talking in right now about the Old Testament, the Hebrew word translated slavery sometimes, really should be understood as a servant, and it has to do with work. For the second point I want to make here, has to do with slavery as it appears in the Old Testament. We're not going to go through all the scriptures in detail. I can't do that. I don't have time at all. Let's talk about it a little bit. In the patriarchal system, we say patriarchal system, that's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, that kind of a thing. You know, nomad, they were nomads, you didn't have to be a nomad, but you always had a patriarchal system, the male-dominated system. And in that system, if you were of means, you had household servants. And you read that in Genesis. So Genesis gives us the background for the rest of the Bible, or the rest of the Old Testament, right, and especially for Israel. So if you want to understand Israel, you got to understand Genesis first. And when you read Genesis... And we don't need to turn there. What's the big picture? Is it like slaves in North America? Well, I don't think so. First time you come in contact with this is, with Abraham. And if you read in Genesis 14, you can write this down if you want, Genesis 14, verses 12 and 14. Remember when the kings, you know, it says when the time of the year when they go out and they, you know, make war with each other. And one of these battles ended up, Sodom was on the losing end of it. And Lot and his family got taken captive. Remember that? What did Abraham do? Who remembers? What did he do? He took his servants and went after them. What good were his servants in going after them? What made them effective? What did he do for them? What's it say? He armed them. Now, just think about that for a second. North American slavery. We didn't arm, I say we, you know, America, we didn't arm our slaves. We didn't pass out the weapons, right? You kept them subjugated, as some of you pointed out. You know, you had to keep control of them. So there's something different about whatever Abraham had. He had several hundred, it says, that were trained that he could arm and take on an expedition and take on these kings. He armed them. In Genesis 15, yeah, that's where he talks. That's where it says he's promised a son, right? He says, what do you mean? He's promised an inheritance. He said, what good is it to give me an inheritance when I don't even have anybody to pass it on to? All I got is this Eliezer at Damascus. What's that tell you? He's going to pass on his entire estate to his most favored slave. Slave, if you want to call it that. His most favored servant. I don't, maybe there are examples of that in American, North American slavery. I doubt it, at least not too many. You know, so this is different. There's something different about this. And the book of Genesis is right at the beginning, we're getting the idea here. There's something different about it. And I wrote down Genesis 24:2, and I don't specifically remember what that was. I didn't put a note as to what it was, so I slipped my brain. Oh. When he sent Eliezer with all kinds of money and stuff and jewels to go look for a son for Isaac, right? A wife for Isaac. And, you know, it's not the kind of slavery that you all had in mind when we talked about this at the beginning. The kind of slavery where you're going to give a good chunk of your, what you're going to pass on to your son, and you're going to give it to one of your quote-unquote slaves and send him on a trip to a foreign land. And he's going to come back with, you know, a woman. Now, if this was slavery in the way that we think about it, that would never happen in a million years, right? You take that money and you go. You'd be gone. So it's not the same. That's what I'm saying. It's not the same, and the Bible doesn't present it as the same. In the Old Testament, if we want to compare it to Roman slavery, did the Roman slaves get holidays? No. New World slaves? Maybe. Maybe they got off Sunday, some of them, depending on how religious some people thought they were. In the Old Testament, what's that fourth commandment say? You take off and your manservant, your maidservant, everybody got off. Enough food. I don't have time. We're going to go through the scriptures next time. But you had to make sure that your slaves were fed. They're slaves. Your servants were fed. You treated them like family. Did they have legal redress? Yes. They had access to the gate if they wanted to. In fact, there was a law. We'll go into that next time. If somebody ran away from their master, you didn't give them back. If you didn't do that, if you didn't give them back in Rome, you would suffer. And remember Paul with Onesimus, and we can talk about this later. He's sent him back to Philemon. He said, "Now, Philemon, what I really wish is that you let him go, or let him be free for the gospel." But he gave him back because it was, you know, you could end up in prison or worse if you didn't return an escaped slave. Anyway, there's all kinds of laws in the Torah about certain sexual protections, laws against kidnapping, no chains, no torture, no physical abuse, these, which in North American slavery we had and in Roman slavery we had. So it's different. Again, it's different. Now, some things about it weren't different, but some things were, and it's important to remember that. Not everything was different. That's why I read Leviticus 25, verses 42, 3, and 4, or 5, whatever it was, early on in the sermon, because those things about owning people and being able to pass them on down to your children, that's still uncomfortable. And I'm not going to address that in this sermon, but just keep that in the back of your mind. Just because I'm saying it was different then, in some ways it wasn't different. And in some ways, as a Christian, I'm still uncomfortable with it, but we'll deal with that next time. Deuteronomy 23 is in verse 15 and 16 is where it talks about not returning a runaway slave to his master. You know, in America, you had to. You had to, right? Even in the Babylonian code under Hammurabi, you had to. What were reasons for slavery? Now, you already pointed out one was debt. That's one of the ways that people got into an extended period of service.
Unable to provide yourself and family.
Okay.
You had to sell yourself.
You got to eat. And you got to feed your family. And if you're unable, then you can have an arrangement with somebody who can provide that. You get to the Roman Empire, by the way, and you have slaves then too, but you had a similar system even among quote-unquote free people, and it was, I can't think of the word, I'm kind of blank here, but what's it called? Poor people would hook up with richer people. That's not what I want to say, but... No, they weren't servants, but you had somebody that you kind of hung out with who made sure that you got enough food and so on. You did his bidding, and there's a word for that, and I'll think of it hopefully before the sermon's over. But that's just the way it's been. That's not the word I'm looking for, but it's kind of like a client relationship. Sorry. But you look at the Torah laws. Oh, by the way, I need to say there's another way the slaves came. And it was especially in the Roman Empire, but also in Israel and those times, and in Egypt.
Well, they were the spoils of war.
Yes, spoils of war. So you go into a nation, and you have a war, and you fight, and people die. Now, how about if you kill the man? And what happens to his wife and kids? They're spoils of war. And there's laws in the Torah about what you can and can't do to that wife. Sometimes you took the men too. Sometimes, depending on whether they had any talent or education, it made a difference as what happened to them. I'll get into that later. But there's no safety net, right? You take this POW, or you say not POW. Maybe you killed the man. His wife doesn't have. There's no Social Security. You can't say, I'll sign up for Social Security. I'll get welfare. I can get on Medicare. No, get the food stamps, whatever they call that now. No, he didn't have that. So how did you eat? Like Dan says, you somehow or another you got to be hooked up with somebody in order to survive. And that's the way the world was. It's not like today, and that's why I've given a bunch of sermons about different aspects of the world the way it was. It was very different than now, and you had to survive. You had to eat, and. If you couldn't do that for yourself, maybe you're crippled. Maybe you got some mental thing or whatever. You're gonna die unless you could get hooked up with somebody. So you got to be taken care of.
Right.
Yes.
The word apprentice?
No, that's not the thing of that one either. it's a shame. Yeah. Well, it's the word. It's the word for like in Rome. If you are a rich guy, you had your gang, and they'd show up in the morning, find out what you wanted them to do, but you also made sure they got bread, and so you're hooked. You had your gang, somebody else had their gang, and there's a word for that relationship that these people had with richer people. I'm sorry, I didn't think of it. All right, so. We talk first about the word and what it means, having to do with work and its relationship with other people. Talk secondly about some of the realities of slavery, in the time, the Bronze Age, which would be when we think that the Exodus was, and Israel's beginning, although Israel extended the time into what you might call the Iron Age, although Israel didn't participate in it. Remember, there's that verse that says they had to go down to the Philistines to get their tools sharpened. So the Iron Age hadn't reached the hills where the Israelites were. They had to go down to the coast where the Iron Age had reached. They had the iron, but they didn't have anything that was hard enough to sharpen it. All right. Third, and this is, I've mentioned these things before, but this to me is very important in understanding what seemed to be somewhat sticky areas in the Old Testament. How should we view the law in general? And we've covered some of these principles before. How should we view the Torah? Some people, and it's part of my culture, my history, you think it's like an instruction book that's got the A, B, C, D. Here's what you do, 1, 2, 3, 4. I don't believe that anymore. Not that it doesn't tell you things you should do. But it's bigger than that. It's way bigger than that. The law, especially to the Jews, who continued using it longer than... their fellow Israelites, the law was always something to be interpreted, applied in different times and in different ways because things change. The Torah didn't change, but the principles were there. They always understood that the purpose of the Torah was to give understanding and teaching that you can apply to make wise judgments. And that's what it's for. It's for the judges, for instance, to know how to judge a certain situation. And the Torah can't spell out every situation that's going to happen for the next 6,000 years or whatever, you know, or 3,000 or whatever, or even the next 20 years. There's going to be specific things that need to be decided. And so what do? Well, you look into the Torah, get the principles, get the understanding, gain wisdom, and then apply that wisdom to this specific instance and come up with a good choice, a good decision. And that's the way it is. Exodus 21, which talks about slaves, and we will go there next week, but I can, let's just look at one thing, just to kind of jump the gun just a little bit. Exodus 21, talking about slaves. Well, it's not talking, I got the King James, so it won't say slaves. Let's see. Exodus 21, verse 18. We'll start there. Oh, that's 22. Not talking about witches. 21, verse 18. If man strive together and one smites another with a stone or with his fist, and he doesn't die but keeps his bed, and if he rises again and walks abroad with his staff, then he that smote him shall be quit, only he shall pay for the loss of his time and shall cause him to be thoroughly healed. So you got a workers' comp deal here, kind of, or an insurance. You're responsible. The guy loses some time, you need to pay for it. There's a principle there. It's not telling only if this happens in the field or only if it happens in the woods. You know, it's not, the specifics are not important. What it's giving you is a principle that if you cause somebody else a loss, you need to make it good. So let's continue on. Verse 20. If a man smite his servant, that's at Eved, okay? Some of you might have a translation that says slave. Does anybody have a translation that says slave? Those of you that turned there? Yeah, okay. If a man slay his servant or his maid with a rod and he die under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Notwithstanding, and here's the one that the atheists will point out. If he continues a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his money. That's the way the King James phrases it. So it sounds like you can beat a slave to within an inch of his life, and as long as he doesn't die for a couple days, you're clear. Is that the wisdom that the Torah is trying to pass on to the judges? What do you think? Now, I phrased it in a way that you're going to say, no. What is it? What's the point, though? Well, we'll do this next week with a lot of verses, but let's look at this one. This verse is giving a bias to a judge. You say, is bias wrong? Well, it can be. If it's bias, you know, a person's face, you know, your person's standing, how much money they have. But a bias in the law is okay. Everybody's got a bias. Who are you going to believe? And what this is telling you is that if you're a judge and, you know, something happened to where the servant got hurt, it's not as likely that the owner or the boss was trying to kill that person, that servant. Because why? Because it's his money. He makes money off of this person. Why would he want to kill this person? So he's not saying that the person's always innocent. That's not the point. But the point is to provide a bit of a bias and say, look, think about it here. Why is he going to want to kill something that's making money for him? The critics of the Bible point to that and say, look, you can beat a slave to within an inch of his life, and as long as he doesn't die right away, you get off. Well, that doesn't make any sense, because if you look at verse 20. If a man smite a servant that was made with a rod and dies on his hand, he shall surely be punished. It says, all right, so you are punishing for death, but look at verse 26 and 7. If a man smite the eye of his servant or the eye of his maid and they perish, the eye perishes, I'm sorry, let him go free. If he hurts his tooth, let him go free. All right, so it's okay to kill them, but you can't knock their tooth out or knock their eye out. No. So when you put it all together, It's just providing a bit of a bias. Like, we shouldn't automatically assume that the master is out to get his servants and hurt them, because that doesn't make any sense. Because that's his money. That's his. This is the word I think is silver. You know, that's how he makes his money. Not because some of your translations probably say because it's his property. Anybody got that one? I don't think it means that. It means it's a silver. That's the word. It's, you know, it's not property in Hebrew. It's silver, if I remember correctly. And the point is that's his money making thing here. Why would he want to hurt it? Not because it's his property and he's allowed to hurt. That's not the point. So if you want to, you got to be careful. You got to be careful to not put our own modern sensitivities back in here. Read what it is and understand what it is. So that's one way about the law. The law is giving general principles that we can apply to specifics, okay? And in this case, it's an example of the law providing a bias. And we got to read it all. It doesn't make sense that you're going to punish somebody by they lose their servant for because they knocked his tooth out, but they can kill him. Yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it? Okay, second thing about the law and how to view it, and I've mentioned this before, and that is, and this is important, I think it's very important, the fact that the Torah, the law, regulates something does not indicate that that particular practice is approved by God. Does that make sense? The fact that the Torah decides to regulate and control a particular practice does not mean that God approves of that practice. Can you think of examples? The one is real obvious because Jesus said it himself. Yes?
Divorce is one.
Divorce. Jesus said from the beginning it wasn't so. Moses did it for the hardness of your hearts. What's that telling us? That's telling us that the Torah is controlling something that God's not in favor of. But he knows we're going to do it anyway, so he has rules about it. And those rules, if you look into them, are to protect the vulnerable ones, the women who don't have a means of income in that patriarchal society. Okay, can you think of any other things that the Torah regulates that are examples of things that the Torah regulates that God doesn't necessarily approve of?
Revenge.
Lex talionis. How do we know that? Well, you know, the Torah says you got to have cities of refuge. And Jesus said, love your enemies. That doesn't square, you know. Good, that's another one. Anything, think of another one. I came up with four or five, I think, when I was thinking. Those are the first two. The Torah has rules about war, doesn't it? I think it's God's desire to have wars. But it is God's desire that if you're going to make war, don't take somebody who just got married. So he regulates it somewhat. But I don't think wars, you know, Matthew 5 says, you know, what's it say for your neighbors? If somebody strikes you on your cheek, give them the other one. That's not the same as going to war. That's different. So I think there's like an example of the Torah regulating something that God doesn't approve of. Anything else? How about having to do with marriages besides divorce? Polygamy. Right? You got all kinds of examples of people in the Bible, the Old Testament, that have more than one wife. What's interesting about them is that they all are in a negative context. I think 100% of them, I didn't look them all up, but anyone I could think of, they're negative. They always some kind of problem. You know, David's kids are out to kill him, whatever. You have whenever there are more than one, there's more than one wife, there's a problem. So the narrative, that is the Bible itself, when you put it all together, is telling you, not a good idea. But knowing that we're going to do it, we got rules. You can't show favor to this one and not take care of this one and give her her food and so forth. There are rules in the Torah about the second wife. But that doesn't mean that God approves of a second wife. And Jesus could have said, and maybe did, we don't have it recorded, well, from the beginning it wasn't so. We have Adam and Eve, all right? Man shall leave his father and mother and be joined unto his wife, not his wives. The first person who had wives, at least listed in Genesis, was it Lamech? Somebody who, you know, he was an evil guy. It wasn't a good guy, so.
And you're supposed to be an elder, or in the New Testament, if you're an elder or whatever, you're supposed to be a husband of one wife.
Yeah. And I would suggest, you know, that slavery is an example, where the Bible regulates the behavior or the practice of having servants that are not in control of their own destiny. It regulates that. But I would suggest that the Bible does not approve of it. Why do I say that? Well, I got, you know, Genesis 1:26 says God made us in his own image. We're all made in, you know, what happened in North American slavery especially? Like I said, it was animals. It was people. It was different. You know, we treated people like animals. They didn't count as a full human. And what, I forget, I'm sorry, those of you that you know your American history better, or some of you that are in school that have had it more recently, what was that decision? It was a Supreme Court decision that said the a slave was worth how much of a person? Three-fifths? And what was the name of that decision? I'm sorry? The Three-Fifths Compromise. Well, it was more than half anyway, but yeah, that's terrible. But that's our history. You know, but the Bible says we're all created in God's image. Thank you. Three-Fifths Compromise. I didn't know what, I thought it had a name, but I didn't remember. And what did he give Adam and Eve dominion over? The garden, the earth, the animals, each other, other people? It doesn't say that. So Jesus could have said, from the beginning it wasn't so. I think that the Bible is teaching us overall that from the beginning it wasn't so. And I got to rush, I'm sorry. All right, I'm getting closer to the end here. Let's talk about the Exodus briefly, because it's like the center point. It's one of the main stories of the Bible, and it's certainly one of the main stories of the Old Testament. In the account of the Exodus, the word eved, which is the word that generally gets translated slavery when you see it, is only used three times of the Israelites. And it's all in one verse. So we ought to just turn there anyway. Exodus 5. And see its context. I didn't look it up in other translations. I doubt if they use the word slave, but if some of yours do, let me know. Exodus 5, excuse me, and verse 15. And this is when, you know, they had to, you know, Pharaoh's making it harder on the Israelites. The officers of the children of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, saying, "Why are you dealing this way with your servants?" Does everybody say servants or something like that? It's a word that we understand mean workers, not slaves. "There's no straw given to unto your servants, and they say to us, 'Make us brick.' And behold, your servants are beaten, but the fault is with your own people." Now, even there in Egypt, where they had lots of slaves, not just Israelites, and usually from conquering, although that wasn't the case here. But they had other slaves, and they realized they needed to make Israelite slaves also, if you want to call them slaves. But they were workers. And the foremen are complaining and say, "You're not being fair here." Well, since when do you have to be fair to slaves? But it wasn't the same. It was a different culture, all right, than ours was. What's interesting, and I'm not going to turn to the verses, and you can do it on your own, that word eved, which is only used there to refer to Israelites in Egypt, is used 20 times to refer to Egyptians serving Pharaoh. Were they slaves to Pharaoh? I didn't put it in my notes. I should have. Remember this Joseph story, right? And he saved up all the, we don't need to turn there. He saved up all the wheat, all the grain, all the whatever. And what did the Egyptians do first? They needed grain. They came to Joseph and they gave him what? Money first. Silver, I guess, whatever. Then the next year they came, or whatever year it was, and they said, "We don't have any money anymore. But we're not going to hide from you like we're all starving here." And then what did they do? I don't remember the order. But they sold their land, their children, right? Didn't they say that? They sold their land, their children, everything, their animals. First it was the animals, I think. Then it was the children, and then land or land children, whichever order it was, and themselves. So according to Genesis, it says that during the period of those 7 years of famine, that the people of Egypt, that we would call the citizens of Egypt, not the outsiders, all became servants in a very real way to Pharaoh. They didn't even own their land anymore. And it goes back to Bob Dylan saying, you know, everybody's got to serve somebody. Of course, the people of Egypt served Pharaoh. I don't know how free they were before that, but at least after that, according to Genesis, they weren't free. They owed everything to Joseph, which meant to Pharaoh. So when you get to the Exodus, in the book of Exodus, it doesn't say there, anyway, that the Israelites are being freed from slavery. It does say bondage sometimes. It doesn't even say that right there. But in the terms of the word eved, which means worker, this worker relationship, you see where I'm going here? What actually happened in the Exodus in terms of working and serving?
They were trying to work. They were rebelling. They were forming a union and leaving.
But they, okay.
They were transferring from being servants of Egypt to being servants to God.
Exactly. They didn't get freed. They just switched bosses. What did God tell Moses to tell Pharaoh? Let my people go that they might serve me in the wilderness and so on. So the way it's written, now you can project our 20th century, 19th century, whatever, feelings on it, but you know, the way it's written, it's like you're all down here serving Pharaoh. Nope, you're going to serve me now. I bought and paid for you. You're going to serve me. And of course, we've talked about this before, as Dan brought out earlier. This is, you know, they make hay on this in the New Testament about how we serve God. But it was the same then. And we can say they were slaves in Egypt or weren't slaves. We can talk about it. But it was different. You know, Pharaoh pleaded with the midwives to kill the children, and he didn't. And he didn't kill them. You know, it was different. The quintessential example of slavery in the Old Testament wasn't anything like North American slavery. So just want to make sure we get the context. I'm not saying their slavery was good and ours is bad. You know, I'm saying all slavery is not good, but it was not the same. Again, to get back to these simple explanations, you'll find any number of explanations, whether it's in print or on, you know, videos and so forth, explaining how slavery in old days, at least way back in the old days, Roman slavery may be an exception here, was very different than what slavery we are familiar with in our own history. And the explanations kind of stop there and talk about some of the details that we'll talk about next time. But they don't explain, all of them do not even touch the fact that the Israelites were allowed, according to Leviticus 25, to have foreigners as slaves and pass them on to their children, own them. So that's something that makes it a little more difficult, and I've found very unsatisfying about most every explanation I read anywhere. They just didn't touch that. Or if they did, they didn't give me an answer that I was satisfied with. Okay. I think I said everything that's in my notes here. I don't want to miss anything, though. But, you know, the Egyptians did make the lives of the Israelites hard. So it was, they didn't have a choice. You know, they were supposed to go get their own straw. When they didn't, they got beaten. So there was a certain amount of very negative stuff going on, even whether you want to call up their servants or their slaves or whatever they are. But the point is, everybody in Egypt was serving somebody. In fact, when you get to the Israelites, I might be getting ahead of my story a little bit, but remember Solomon? He's building all this stuff, and he wants to get all the lumber from Lebanon and all this. And what did he do? There wasn't a military draft, but he had a draft. Everybody had to work. You know, they had, I think it was 1 month on, 2 months off or something, but it was forced labor. They had to go up and they had to work for the king. Forced labor. So even in Israel, the kings, you know, weren't following the Torah, and they had their own slaves. And eventually they had, you know, military drafts and so forth. But you think about military, again, when you think about the old days, and I've never talked about war, and maybe one day I will when I understand it better. But in the Bible, in those times, especially in the Bronze Age, you didn't have professional armies. You know, it was time to make war. People like Abraham just rounded up their people and gave them some weapons and all went off to war. And it was like that. For the most part, I mean, Rome obviously had a professional military, and other, you know, Hannibal did, and different ones did. But in general, you just took people, and they went with you. And what was their pay? Spoils of war. You didn't have to pay them. The Roman military, they got paid. And John Baptist told them to be happy with their pay. But in general, you know, you went off to war and you conquered your enemy, and the troops ransacked and took what they could for themselves, and that was their pay. And you couldn't do that for too long because you had to get back home and take care of the crops and eat. You know, so there was a time, I think in Genesis says, at the time of year when they went out and made war. Well, there's only a certain period of time you could do that. Because if you did it for too long, you'd starve because nobody would be taking care of the fields. So it was a different world, again, very different. By the way, back in Leviticus, I didn't read verse 55. And I keep promising you we will look at these in more detail next week. But notice, this is Leviticus 25, that a lot of details about having servants. The last verse in the chapter says, "For unto me the children of Israel are servants. They are my servants whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." So God claims ownership. Does he do that in the New Testament? Absolutely. 1 Corinthians, what is it, 6 verse 20? You are bought with a price, therefore I glorify God, and so forth. You know, so it's a New Testament corollary to that, but we serve God, and we are his servants. He's bought us and paid for us, and he owns us. What's the difference? He's a good boss. You know, there's no abuse, all right? But the concept of being a slave is not something the Bible frowns on. The Bible frowns on mistreating slaves. And in the Old Testament, if you want to call it slavery, you can call it that, servanthood, whatever you want to call it, this eved word. It was just the way that people made it, because some people couldn't make it otherwise. They were in debt, they were sick, but whatever it is, they needed to eat. They'd sell themselves or their kids or whatever for a period of time, and we'll go through the laws next time. In Israel, you could only, 7 years and so forth, but you had to take care of yourself, and they didn't have a safety net, so you hooked up with somebody who could take care of you.
Well, Jesus called himself a servant.
I'm sorry?
Jesus called himself a servant.
Oh, yeah, he is. Yeah. That's the kind of boss he is. He's a boss that serves his workers. That's a good boss. Now we've all been in the workforce long enough to know that not every boss is like that. But that's the way Jesus. Yeah, that's the example he set. His way of being a boss is to serve. And I thank Brad and Arlene for those books I have from John Maxwell that they've given me, or they gave me the Bible, and then I've got the Maxwell Bible, and I've got some other books by him. He talks about servant leadership. You know that Jesus exemplified there. Okay. And by the way, John 8:33. You write this down. Remember when Jesus said the truth will make you free, and the Pharisees there said, "Well, you know, we're children of Abraham. We've never been slaves to anybody." And I've read a thing. It's like, and you probably read it too. It's like, what are they talking about? They're descended from the Israelites in Egypt, but maybe they read it the way we just read through, where the Bible doesn't really call them slaves. They were workers, and so was everybody else in Egypt. Everybody had to work for Pharaoh, one way or the other. Nobody was free. In that sense, in a modern sense of free, but in the old way of looking at free, maybe they thought they weren't slaves. I don't know what they were thinking, but they did say that, and it's kind of an odd thing to say. If if the big part of your history was that you were led out of that condition. Everybody has to work for somebody. We might call that slavery. Oh, here I've got that. It was 1 Kings. If you wanted to look up about Solomon and his work party, 1 Kings chapter 5, verses 13 to 15 talks about it. So freedom, at least the way I see it, and the way we see it today, it's a modern concept. Didn't have that before. And as we talked about already, how free really are we? You know, can we disconnect? Okay, I want to close with talking just very briefly about slavery in the Roman context, or the Greek and Roman context. In Rome, I've talked about this before, so I won't take a long time. In Rome, there were slaves everywhere. I say Rome, in the Roman Empire. Estimates are that in the general Roman Empire, you had about 10% of the people were slaves. And that was typically, the source of those slaves was typically from conquering, you know, in wartime. If you were in and around Rome, that part of Italy, wasn't called Italy then, the slave population was probably closer to 30% of the people were slaves. So the Roman economy ran on slave labor and slaves in general. And you couldn't rebel. If you did, Most of you have seen Spartacus, I guess, if you're of a certain age. You know, you got crucified. If you were unskilled, uneducated, you worked in the salt mines. You worked in other very unsafe, unsanitary conditions that you probably didn't live very long. So their slavery was, in some ways, at least in, for some of them, was just as inhumane as ours was. If you were skilled, if you had an education, it opened up many more opportunities. And there were slaves that had very high positions in certain households, just like Joseph did in Egypt, somebody mentioned. so that the same thing happened in the Roman Empire. And being a slave, it wasn't a racial thing. It was because you were from somebody that got conquered. And if you, again, if you were skilled or educated, you might be a tutor to some rich people's kids. I mean, it wasn't the type of thing that you couldn't escape. There was something called manumission. You could let people become free. You could buy your own freedom. As I remember when Paul was being kind of arrested and led away from the people that were trying to kill him, and he told the officer there that he was a Roman. Like, they were ready to beat him. He said, "Oh, you can't beat me. I'm a Roman." And the officer, what did the officer say? He said, I paid a lot of money. He said, I'm a citizen too, but I had to pay a lot of money for it. How about you? You know. And Paul was from a free city. Tarsus was a free city, so he was a citizen. But you know, I had a lot of opportunities. If you look in, like, Daniel, you know what happened in the book of Daniel? It says it wasn't Nebuchadnezzar, it was the Persian Empire. You know, they took the best and the brightest out of Israel. They would come, and there'd be, like, excuse me, when they would deport the people from Israel or deport the people from Judah, wherever they were doing, they'd come in and they'd take the smart ones. And they had opportunities. They might have been slaves, but it's kind of like they're people that are being, it's forced labor, but they're not getting beaten. They're being used for their brains, okay? And usually they get assimilated. I didn't mention this before, but I heard James Hoffmeyer. He's an Egyptian specialist, I guess you'd say. Say that in Egypt, the majority of foreigners that would be captured and brought into slaves, that from what they can tell, I don't know what sources they have and how they determine this from their research and from whatever they dig up. But they said that these people don't tend to remain in secluded groups of slaves. They, after a generation or two, they have been amalgamated into the regular society. They've intermarried and they become just part of the population. And to a certain extent, that happened in Rome also, because people there was upward mobility, but. And I don't know if I want to talk about this now. I guess I can. We'll talk about it next time. But, you know, Paul can't just come along and say, you know what, you Christians need to free your slaves, because that was against the law. If you had, I forget how it is, if you had three, you could release one. If you had 10, you could release three. There were certain rules to how many you could release. You couldn't just let them all go. And if you released a slave before they were age 30, there was almost no way they could ever become a citizen. So there's all these rules and laws, and, you know, the New Testament church did not see the need to try to turn the world upside down in that way. They turned it upside down in their own society, where you had slaves right along with people, free people in the congregation, and you had slaves who were deacons, free people who weren't, or whatever. You had, you know, there was no class within the church, or wasn't supposed to be anyway. Okay, so I'm done. What we have is a slavery that's very, very different. The words that are used, or the one Hebrew word that's used, really means worker. It has to do with the relationship between the one working and those who works for. And probably when you read in the Old Testament and you see the word slave, it's probably better if we used, I'm suggesting, and so is Peter Williams at the lecture. He, if it was up to him on the English Standard Version, pretty much every time that word's used in the Old Testament, it would be translated as servant. And his point, and I heard him say this in another panel discussion, his point is that if we just put, you know, always translate the word the same. If it's only one word in Hebrew, let's always translate it into the same word in English, and people will understand what it means by seeing all the different situations in which it's used, just the way we learn language as a kid. You know, we get up, you know, some words mean different things in different contexts, and it can be the same. So rather than having a translator try to tell us what they think it means in context, perhaps we should just let people who read it figure it out, just like our kids figure it out when they learn our languages. So that's Eved, slavery in the Old Testament, very different. You were right on top of that with the different reasons and ways that people became slaves or servants or, you know, indentured servitude and POWs, all those different ways. Again, we talked about how the law is a guide. It's a template. It gives the judges wisdom and previous experience, what they call that, so that they can know how to precedent, so they know how to judge specific situations. And the law, I feel very strongly, you seemed to agree, the law does restrict and control certain practices and behaviors that it doesn't approve of. It's just trying to put a lid on it because of the hardness of our hearts. In the Exodus, as Tammy said, it's not so much about some people being freed as being just transferred from ownership of Pharaoh to ownership of Yahweh. That's the way the Bible presents it anyway. And when we get to the New Testament, the Greco-Roman slavery is more cruel, different, more like North American slavery. What we're going to do next time I'm here is we're going to actually dig into the scriptures and see why the verses say what they say about servants and how they were to be treated, who's vulnerable, how the Torah protects them, and we will try to even have a better understanding. I can't guarantee a perfect one by any means, but we'll try to have a better understanding even of the uncomfortable things like passing slaves down to your children and so forth. See you then.